America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, Truth in Broadcasting.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Grandpa Fred, tomorrow, his first debate. Rich Galen is with us. He's the senior advisor to the Fred Thompson campaign. His personal website, Mullings.com, M-U-L-L-I-N-G-S.com. And, Rich, what's Fred's campaign site?
I'm sorry, I said that. I couldn't hear you, Tom. I'm sorry.
And what is Fred Thompson's campaign site?
Oh, it's Fred08.com.
Fred08.com. Okay, great. We should get that in as well.
Thank you.
I noticed the, first of all, tomorrow night.
Yeah, we win. Yay. Well,
we win. Yeah. Tomorrow night is going to be Fred's first debate. You're expecting him to do well.
Yeah.
I'm assuming. I mean, it's kind of a softball question.
You raise a better point though, that anybody who's ever done post debate spin knows there's only one answer. We won.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter if your candidate threw up on his or her shoes, then it was a victory for everybody who's ever suffered from a stomach virus. Doesn't matter what happens. We won.
Okay, so you're all ready. Now, today in today's Wall Street Journal, a fairly substantial story about Fred Thompson on page 4.
Yeah, really.
Thompson turns to taxes, and it says he has hinted at politically risky proposals to rein in Social Security and Medicare benefits and appears to be heading toward proposing tax code changes to help lower corporate taxes as well. Do you really think that running a campaign based on cutting Social Security and Medicare at a time that over 70% of Americans say that they want Social Security solvent and they want a national health care program is going to win him anything?
Well, he didn't say he was cutting benefits. What he said, the full story is that he wants to, first of all, it doesn't affect anybody who's either on or near collecting Social Security. That's number one. Number two is that what you said is exactly right. People want Social Security to be solvent, and what he's proposing is one of those things. It's in a broader context, Tom, and I know that we don't have time to get through the whole thing, but entitlements are growing at an unsustainable rate, and the point is, do you want, when you retire, because you're significantly younger than I am, when you retire, your choices are you going to have Social Security benefits at all? And what he's suggesting is a fairly modest difference, and that is indexing the Social Security benefits based upon your work experience to costs rather than wages, to index it to inflation rather than wages, and that alone would add 75 years to the Social Security program, and it would be virtually unnoticed by anybody of your age and your age group. Because it just would be the way it was when you got there.
Yeah, well, as it is, the best projections, I mean, the government projections are that Social Security is not going to run into problems for another 20, 25 years.
Well, that's right. But 20 years.
And if we lifted the cap, there would never be a problem.
Well,
I mean, why not just have people who make more than $91,000 a year pay the same Social Security taxes as people who make less than $90,000?
I think it's $97,000, but
97.
But by that time, we're all going to be eligible for S-CHIP, so it's going to go out that door.
I don't understand.
Well, the proposal that the Democrats put on the president's desk, knowing he would veto it, allows families making up to $83,000 in some.
Yeah, in some very rare situations. Now, this is a serious question here, Rich.
Why not just do away
with the cap on Social Security?
Well, I think you could do that as a tax increase, which I know you're in favor of, or you could do it the other way and have people not index or means test the benefits at the other end, which is to say, that
turn it into a welfare program.
No, if I choose to keep working past 65, then my Social Security benefits would go down, assuming that I was making over some period, and that too would have the same effect as what you're looking for, but wouldn't increase anybody's taxes, and it would be voluntary on my part. I could either continue to work or not continue to work.
But I just don't get this. Why, why, in your opinion, well, perhaps you can explain this to me. We're talking with Rich Galen, Fred Thompson's senior advisor. Why is it that somebody who makes $20 million a year should only pay Social Security tax on the first $97,000 and pay no Social Security tax whatsoever after that. Whereas, so you know, with $3 million a year income, they're paying, what, about 3 or 4% of their total income is actually taxable for Social Security taxes.
Well, because
somebody who makes $97,000 a year, 100% of their income is taxable.
Because, well,
why is that? Why do we want to reward the millionaires and billionaires and screw the working people?
Stop, and I'll tell you why. The reason is because you don't continue to draw. You don't get any more Medicare benefits if you're making $3 million a year than if you're making $60,000 a year, and you don't draw any more Social Security. Your Social Security benefits don't go up, forever. They are capped. And so the amount that you pay in is similarly capped. I don't think there's anything unfair about
that. But Social Security is not a retirement program. A third of Social Security payments are going to literally widows, orphans, and disabled people.
Well, that's an expansion of the system that was never contemplated back when it was formulated. But I'm not opposed to it.
It was part of the original proposal by Franklin Roosevelt.
It was not disability benefits. No, never. The point to your question is that benefits are capped and therefore payments are capped. That I think makes absolute sense.
So in other words, because there is a cap on the amount of money that Social Security is viewed as basically an insurance program.
It's become a welfare program, so it's completely different from what it was.
Well, semantics, I suppose. But nonetheless, because it's a program for all of us, that millionaires and billionaires should pay a much smaller percentage of their income into it.
Why not just cap all taxes?
They
don't receive any more in benefits at the other side. It's not clear to me why you making $800,000 a year as a gigantic radio host should have to
pay in my dreams
the last dollar if you're not going to receive benefits any more than somebody who makes $60,000 or $65,000 a year.
I am part of the society. I'm a member of the society, and if I were making that kind of money, and I would be pleased to pay Social Security tax on all of it.
Well, the fact of the matter is that there have been a lot of years where I've
made above the cap, and I always thought, this isn't fair.
Well, you can pay more. Feel free.
it's not going to go into the trust fund. It's really not. You over on Mullings.com, your blog, Rich Galen, you're defending Rush Limbaugh. Why should our tax dollars be paid to put this guy on Armed Forces Radio and then have him tell our soldiers that everybody knows that they all signed up to go over to Iraq and that anybody who opposes the war is a phony soldier? Why should our tax dollars pay for that?
Why our tax dollars should pay for it is a different issue. But that's not what he said. What he was talking about, and you know this perfectly well, was he was talking about the ABC report about people who are phony soldiers who have never served, have never put on a uniform, who run around and claim that they have served and claim that they've seen atrocities which they never saw because they were never there. Those were the phony soldiers he was talking. It was a Brian Ross piece on ABC. It was very powerful. That's what Rush was talking about. He wasn't talking about real soldiers who oppose the war. That's not at all what he said.
Well, as I recall, here's the actual clip.
Another mic, this one in Olympia, Washington. Welcome to the EIB Network. Hello.
Hi, Rush. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I'm going to
skip ahead here a little bit on this.
Then Iraq itself would collapse, and we'd have to go right back over there within a year or so.
There's a lot more than that that they don't understand. If a next guy that calls here, I'm going to ask him, why should we pull? What is the imperative of pulling out?
I'm sorry, we don't have enough time for me to find it. And this clip I've got is way too. I got a 2-minute clip here. But the fact of the matter is, if you listen to the clip, he actually did say that people who oppose the war are phony soldiers.
The context of the phony. I didn't listen to the clip. I read the transcript, and the context of the clip clearly had to do with the ABC Brian Ross report.
It did not. I'm telling you, if you want to stick around, I'll play the clip right after the break, and we can discuss it if you'd like.
I have real work to do because I have to pay my Social Security, man. What are you kidding me?
Yeah, right. So, So anyhow, you support his continuing being on Armed Forces Radio.
Yeah, it's only there because soldiers want to listen to it. This goes all the way back to Adrian Cronauer.
Uh-huh. Okay. All righty. Rich Galen, the senior advisor to Grandpa Fred's campaign, the Fred Thompson campaign. And what do you say? Is Thompson06.com is the website there?
I think it would be 08 would be a better bet.
Or 08, yes. Thank you very much. Rich, good having you on. Thanks for talking to us. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
So, for the record, just, you know, for the record, because the record is being aggressively reinvented by Mr. Limbaugh and his friends, and in fact, Mr. York in the National Review didn't even address the fact that Rush himself edited his own clip, and his partisans are out there. Here is Limbaugh's comment, in context, unedited.
No, it's not. And what's really funny is they never talk to real soldiers. They like to pull these soldiers to come up out of the blue and stop the media.
The phony soldiers.
If you talk to a real soldier, they're proud to serve. They want to be over in Iraq. They understand their sacrifice, and they're willing to sacrifice for the country.
They joined to be in Iraq. You know where you're going these days, the last 4 years, if you sign up. The odds are you're going there or Afghanistan or somewhere.
Yeah, or somewhere. So, anyhow, it rather boggles my mind that you've got all these Republicans running around saying, "Oh, we got to defend Rush, and we got to defend this kind of rhetoric." And can you imagine if Al Gore or John Kerry had said something, or for that matter, if even a well-known Democratic commentator, except that, frankly, I don't recall there being any. Back, you know, during the last the 2000 election, when the Supreme Court gave the election to Bush. Also, here in the Wall Street Journal, all three of the leading Republican candidates, Thompson, Giuliani, and Romney, by the way, today got thrown off the island on our 620 KPOJ presidential straw poll. It's interesting. John Edwards is winning on the Democratic side. Neck and neck with Dennis Kucinich, and over on the Republican side, Romney, boom, thrown off. Ron Paul is winning. So, and my cat Higgins is doing very well in the write-in candidates, although Al Gore is pretty much sweeping the field with regard to write-ins. But in any case, all three of the Republican candidates, Thompson, Giuliani, and Romney, the three so-called front leaders, have this, quoting Amy Schatz in today's Wall Street Journal, all three have embraced President Ronald Reagan's belief in supply-side economics and a market approach to controlling health care costs. In other words, just leave it to the big corporations. They will solve all our problems. Everything will be fine if we just do it like that. And what's amazing is that Americans are figuring out how bankrupt this is. I mean, Paul Krugman today. His editorial in the New York Times talking about how Bush, you know, conservatives are saying they don't like Bush because he's not conservative. Actually, he's following the conservative playbook perfectly. And the consequence of that, in the 7 years since George Bush became president, since he was first appointed by the Supreme Court to be president of the United States, over 5 million people have slipped into poverty. Nearly 7 million Americans have lost their health insurance. Average median household income is down by nearly $1,300. 3 million manufacturing jobs have been lost. 3 million American workers have lost their pensions. Home foreclosures are now the highest on record. The personal savings rate is below zero. I mean, this is something that literally has not happened since the Great Depression. The real earnings of college graduates in the United States These guys run around and say, oh, the solution to everything is education. Let's get people. They don't want to pay to put people through college, but yeah, let's get more people in college. The real earnings of college graduates have gone down by 5% since George Bush became president. Entry-level wages for male and female high school graduates have fallen by over 3%. And wages and salaries, actual income from working, as opposed to income from arbitrage, from moving money around, which has become one of the major sources of income in the United States, wages and salaries are now at the lowest share of GDP since 1929. The lowest share of GDP since 1929. It has never been this bad. There is, by the way, there is absolutely no relationship. And there's a great blog over at Huffington Post. Hale Stewart has put up this chart that goes back from 1940 to 2000, well, till today, showing revenues, actual government revenues from taxes, year by year by year. And what it shows, what it demonstrates is, okay, we went to a 91% income tax rate. There was a 40% increase in taxes, in tax collections. What it shows is that there's no relationship whatsoever between cutting taxes and increasing tax revenues. None. Zero. Zip. Nada. In fact, as you may, you know, intuitively guess, when you raise tax levels, you increase tax revenues. Pretty straightforward stuff. Tax cuts do not pay for themselves. This is from the St. Louis Federal Reserve's FRED data system. No meaningful acceleration of tax revenues under these supply-side experiments. And finally, a group of World War II vets are speaking out. John Amato, writing over at Crooks and Liars. For six decades, they held their silence. The group of World War II veterans kept a military code, telling virtually no one of their top secret work interrogating Nazi prisoners of war at Fort Hunt. But now Henry Kolm, 90, an MIT physicist, says we got more information out of a German general with a game of chess or ping pong than they do today with their torture. Another interrogator from World War II, he said, during the many interrogations, I never laid hands on anyone. We extracted information in a battle of wits.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. Welcome back. 866-303-2270, our telephone number, tomhartman.com. If you want to drop into our live chat room, airamerica.com. If you want to participate in the blog, Phyllis in Louisiana. Hey, Phyllis, welcome to the program.
Hello?
Phyllis, you're on the air.
Hey. Hi. I waited so long, I didn't know. I just was so angry at that man for saying that Social Security is welfare when every single beneficiary has either paid into it for 40 quarters or someone in their family has. I have.
Yeah, well,
I'm 65.
Truth be told, he did not say it was welfare. What he said was, as I recall, that Fred Thompson is suggesting that the benefits, that the revenue that comes to people from Social Security should be means tested.
That was his words. And
oh, okay.
I've
he did.
Been paying. I'm 65. I've been paying into it since 1959. Mm. And for me, that's a contract that I had with my government.
Yes. Yeah, it's a pension. I mean, it literally is. And what's amazing and tragic, frankly, is that so few people in the generation that's coming up right now, so few people, you know, under 30, maybe under 40, basically, who came of age since Reagan, don't even know what pensions are. They don't understand the idea of, you know, that essentially it's like an insurance policy. Everybody's thinking in terms of 401ks, you know, defined defined contribution plans as opposed to defined benefit plans. Defined benefit plan of pension is where you are going to get a certain amount of money until the day you die, and you can count on it, as opposed to you've got a certain pot of money, and when it's gone, which is what everybody is being moved to. Phyllis, your point is well made, and thank you very much. I appreciate the call. John in Los Angeles. Hey, John. John, you're on the air.
Hello.
Johnson. Yeah. Hey, John. What's up?
Yeah, I just wanted to say that because today's Columbus Day, I wanted to wish you a happy Invaders Day. Because,
yeah, well, thank you. We're going to actually, in the second hour of the program, get into Columbus Day at some length. So.
Oh, good, yeah. Good. Well, anyway, I wanted to mention about the tax thing, whether it's Social Security or any tax. Since we tend to want to just gravitate toward the material side of people's contributions to society, the material side is best, you know, exemplified by taxes, and by taking into account the fair share of participation materially, someone who makes millions of dollars or hundreds of thousands of dollars a year should pay their fair share, and their a larger share than someone who doesn't and only has people who don't contribute as much materially and maybe more in other ways to society.
Yeah, Teddy Roosevelt pointed out that the greater the wealth of a person, the more of a load they are on the commons, essentially, on all the infrastructure. The greater the opportunity that they had and the greater use they make of everything from the courts to the banks to everything else, and that therefore it's appropriate that there be some sort of a progressive taxation. Now, Social Security is not progressive taxation. First of all, it's a flat tax. And secondly, it's a flat tax that only hits people who make less than $97,000 a year. And anybody who makes more than that, it doesn't tax them at all on any of their income over that point. So it's not only not a progressive tax, it's not even a flat tax, it's a totally regressive tax. And you're right, the wealthy folks tend to live longer, they're going to get more benefits out of Social Security. Interesting. Alex in Scottsdale, Arizona. Hey, Alex, welcome to the program.
Yeah, I thought that was completely out of line with what Limbo said. Taking in the fact that he's a draft dodger, he had a herpes boil the size of a Frisbee on his rear end when he went to go check out or check in, and he didn't make it to Vietnam. And for him to talk about people and say they're phony soldiers is just totally ludicrous.
Yeah, well, as I said, as a talk show host, he has the right to say anything he wants, and certainly that's not among the more outrageous and culturally obscene things that are being said on a regular basis on right-wing talk radio. On the other hand, on Armed Forces Radio, being broadcast to the troops, being broadcast to our soldiers, I have some serious concerns about that kind of a message, and that's where I draw the line. You can hear Mark Levin or Michael Savage on any of a dozen other right-wing hosts, and some left-wing hosts for that matter, just going off ballistic on any given day of the week in ways that ultimately the marketplace has to decide. It's the old Don Imus thing. You know, it's if you've got the advertisers, if the advertisers are with you, if the radio stations are going to put you on the air, if there's a network that'll syndicate you, fine. And, you know, as I said, I have no problem with Rush Limbaugh saying pretty much anything until we start talking about whether or not my tax dollars are being used to syndicate it to our soldiers all around the world. Quinn in Sunnyvale, California. Hey, Quinn.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. You really set up what I was going to talk about really well. Thank you for that. I really think just after all that this has happened and listening to Rush and Ann Coulter and the nicest of them all, Michael Wiener Savage, I really think that they're just entertainers, you know. There's no way that I think someone like that who has that much money can really believe all of those things. Well, I guess the money doesn't have anything to do with it. But I really think that what they've done is actually worse than if they really did believe it, because what they're doing is they're saying these really outrageous things, you know, to get in their advertisers, to get in their listeners, and their listeners start to believe it.
Yeah.
And,
I thought it was a revealing moment after the 2006 election when Limbaugh said that he felt liberated and that he no longer had to carry water for the Republicans. And that frankly startled me. I had always assumed that there was some integrity to what he was saying. And you know, and I suppose, you know, being in this business, I shouldn't have made that assumption, but I guess I was judging him by myself. I would have a very, very hard time going on the radio every day and saying something that I didn't believe. It's like telling lies. You know, my dad always used to say, you know, don't ever tell lies because you'll never be able to remember them. You know, it's like, you know, just as a lazy person, you know, you don't want to do that. And so I don't get it how he could do that. By the way, the good news, and thanks, Quinn, for pointing that out. The good news, he passed his drug test. This is the last month of his 18 months of probation for being a druggie. And he has announced that he passed his drug test. And by the way, during the 18 months that he was on probation, according to press reports, he earned about $50 million. Not bad. And apparently has stopped giving a good chunk of it to his maid to go out and buy Percodan for him or whatever it was she was buying. Bob in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Bob.
Hey, Tom. Can I recommend the guest, Naomi Klein? I think she'd make an excellent guest for you.
She's been on this program several times.
In fact,
she was on 2 weeks ago about her book, Disaster Capitalism.
The Shock Doctrine, I think.
Or Shock Capitalism, or what? Yeah.
Or whatever.
Yeah,
what? Oh, okay. Well, I'm sorry I missed that show.
Shock Doctrine. Yeah.
I wanted to give the Al Franken solution to Social Security.
And that
Hello?
Is? Yeah, I'm listening.
Yeah, Al Franken, I think it's one of the better suggestions I've heard. His solution is to keep the tax where it is up to the $91,000 income. And then from $91,000, I think he said up to $250,000, you'd have a donut hole where you would not tax those people because those are like middle-income business-type people that would probably get hurt by the regressive tax. But from $250,000 and above, because these are the incomes that have seen the greatest gains here over the last 30 years of Milton Friedman economics, they would be taxed because they, of course, have got the disposable income to pay the tax.
Right.
And this is
what John Edwards actually proposed at the last debate. I was surprised it didn't get more coverage, but that was Edwards' point. You know, they went around and they said, the question was, Social Security can be completely, all the problems with it can be completely solved forever by simply removing the cap. Do you support that? And several candidates said yes. Hillary Clinton said no. She wants to appoint a commission. Dennis Kucinich was yes, you know, remove the cap. I don't recall the exact position of everybody else. But John Edwards said, my position is that we should remove the cap above $250,000 and leave that, like you said, a donut hole there between $97,000 and $250,000 because in many cities in America, two people, a two-person income, working hard, the cost of living is really, really high in a lot of parts of America. And so he said, it's the upper end of the middle class, but it's still the middle class. And so, you know, above $250,000, I think that we have this consensus that it's not the middle class. I didn't realize Al Franken is taking that position as well. If he is, good on him. Al's a great guy, and I wish him the very best. I have a feeling he's going to be the next senator from Minnesota, and a fine thing it is. Kate in Eureka, California. Hey, Kate. Kate?
Oh, I'm sorry. Hello?
Yeah, you're on the air.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'm listening to Rich Galen. I just got a headache. I don't know where to start to correct everything he said that was wrong. But my main correction this time is to what he said about the S-CHIP program. The income level of $83,000 was something that was requested by the New York delegation and did not end up in the final bill. My daughter is on the program here in California where it's called Healthy Families, and if he wants to actually get some facts about it, he should go to their website and look at the income levels that are allowed. We pay premiums. It's run through private insurance companies, so maybe he might be a little more interested in finding out some facts.
Yeah. And and you know, it's the Fred Thompson.
I don't know. Fred isn't big on facts. I know that.
Yeah. We still have the Soviet Union out there to worry
That's
about.
True.
You know, indeed. Kate, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for the,
all right,
for the
have
heads
a good
up
one.
On that. Much, much appreciated. 45 minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Does Grandpa Fred really want to cut Social Security and Medicare? Should Rush be removed from Armed Forces Radio? And actually, some good news here. Good news. Larry Johnson's blogging. He's suggesting that in all probability, we may not attack Iran. That would be fine.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news. This is Air America Radio.
Minutes before the hour, about half of the cabinet ministers in the Nouri al-Maliki government in Iraq have left their posts. The Shiite Alliance in Parliament, this by Joshua Partlow in today's Washington Post, the Shiite Alliance in Parliament, which once controlled 130 of the 275 seats, is disintegrating with the defection of two important parties. Basically, the bottom line here is that the government is disintegrating, and as one of the Kurdish leaders said, this is all about. He said, I don't think there is something called reconciliation, and there will be no reconciliation as such. To me, it is a very inaccurate term. This is a struggle about power. This is from Deputy Prime Minister Barham Salih, a Kurd. In any country where you have an unemployment rate of 50, 60, 70%, because the United States came in and imposed unilaterally shock doctrine, disaster capitalism, laissez-faire capitalism, whatever you want to call it, as Naomi Klein so brilliantly has points out in her new book and also in her piece for The Atlantic, I think it was a couple of years ago, Year Zero, Iraq Year Zero. In any country where you go in and you say, oh, we're just going to leave everything to the corporations. We don't really need to have a government. Or the government should play a very small role. We want to have a Ronald Reagan, at least the way he talked. I mean, he grew government, but the way he talked. Whenever you do that, you destroy the institutes of civil society. And when you destroy the institutions of civil society, guess what? Civil society goes with it. That's amazing. Dennis in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Dennis, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. Funny that you should intro that like that. What I'm calling about is in reference to the New York Times article about the three top Republican candidates coming out in favor of trickle-down economics. And
yeah, it was the Wall Street Journal, by the way.
Embracing Reaganism.
Yeah.
I can't believe that at this stage in our country's history, people are still embracing supply-side economics? Are they kidding?
I know. It is mind-boggling. It has not. If you look at the 40-year period leading up to Reagan coming into office, you saw, you know, significant annual growth. Annual growth was in the 3 to 4% range in the GDP. And the growth of the middle class was strong and solid. And if you look at the period from Reagan to today, it has, especially if you pull the 6 or the 8 Clinton years out, you have average growth that's just a little over 1%. And you put the Clinton years back in, it's in the neighborhood of 2%. But supply-side economics just doesn't work. I mean, that's the bottom line. It doesn't work. And cutting taxes to raise government revenue doesn't work. It's very, very simple. And the biggest thing that these guys have done, Dennis, and your point is really well made, the biggest thing that they've done is that it is borrow-and-spend economics. Reagan ran up a larger debt than every other president in the history of this country combined, and now George Bush is on track to beat Reagan. So we've got these two guys who have run up some $7 trillion in debt between the two of them in that neighborhood, and we're paying hundreds of billions of dollars a year that we could be using to hire teachers, to rebuild our bridges and infrastructure, to build schools, to build hospitals, to pay for a national healthcare system. I mean, so many things that could be done. We're spending hundreds of billions of dollars a year instead on interest on the national debt. Ralph in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Hey, Ralph, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom. On Social Security, I think what removing the cap is very simply extremely fair. Remember, the Social Security system has subsidized U.S. finances in Washington for decades. If it hadn't, two things would have happened. Number one, we would have had to pay more in taxes, and that means the rich would catch more of it than we did. Number two, the U.S. would have to pay a higher interest rate.
And right. Or number three, we would have had to borrow more money, which means we would have had to pay a higher interest rate. I'm assuming that that's your
If it's not from a graduated income tax, then it's from a higher interest rate.
Right.
Now, remember Bush said that, gee, if my talking about me, if Ralph's Social Security money, instead of going to the government, he'd been able to invest it, I'd get 9%.
I don't remember making that specific claim, but
Tom,
yeah.
Because
yeah.
What the Social
Security, I wish I knew, Ralph.
Yeah, what the Social Security bonds are getting, the mandatory loan from the lower and middle class, is at most 5%.
Yeah.
That other 4% is what the rich got, minimum, and we didn't. And now it says, well, no, we can't pay Social Security because we can't afford it. I want my investment back, Tom. I want that 4%.
Yeah, well, it was just rhetoric. I mean, it was Bush talking through the top of his hat, as he so often does. But your point is well made, Ralph, and I appreciate it. Mark in Oakland, California. Hey, Mark, welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks, Tom. You know, if anybody can be said to have been blinded by the right and by Reagan, it was Rich Galen. I knew him in high school when he was known as Richie Galen. This was a very liberal Jewish suburb of Chicago, Skokie, Illinois. And I think his parents, I don't know what they think of him, but I'm sure they'd be turning in his grave to know how he turned out.
I really don't want to get into personal stuff about individuals, Mark. I appreciate the call, but it's just really not fair, particularly when he's not here to defend himself. Joe in Queens, New York. Hey, Joe.
Yes, about the phony soldier slap.
The
only phony is Lynn Bagg's excuses. You know, if you follow the sequence of his excuses, you can see how phony they are. His first phony excuse was that he was referring to that one particular soldier until it was pointed out that he used the plural. So now this is, you know, the 2 days later where he comes up with this ABC report on these phony soldiers. Only thing is they were irrelevant to the conversation because they were not criticizing the war. So then a few days later, he starts saying there are plenty of soldiers out there just like Macbeth. Was that his name?
Yeah.
Well,
it's just the whole process, the whole evolution of this thing has been absolutely bizarre. I'm surprised he didn't just say, you know, gee, I shouldn't have said that. It would have been the end of it. You know, everybody makes mistakes, except Limbaugh, apparently. 57 minutes past the hour. Coming up next, how do we change America to stop worshiping violence here on Columbus Day?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio. Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Well, it's Columbus Day. What does that mean? Now, what's the significance of this holiday? I guess it's a holiday if you work for the post office or a bank or something, but here's an opening quote from Christopher Columbus. In 1503, he wrote a letter to the King and Queen of Spain. He said, "Gold is most excellent. Gold constitutes treasure, and he who has it does all he wants in the world and can even lift souls up to paradise." George Herbert Walker Bush in 1989 said, "Christopher Columbus not only opened the door to a new world, but also set us an example for all of us by showing what monumental feats can be accomplished through perseverance and faith." Right. When Christopher Columbus first landed on Hispaniola, the island which is now the Dominican Republic and Haiti, in 1492, virtually the entire island was covered by lush forest. The Taino Indians who lived there had an apparently idyllic life prior to Columbus from the reports left to us by literate members of Columbus's crew, such as Miguel Cunio. For example, when Columbus and his crew arrived on their second visit to Hispaniola, they took captive about 2,000 local villagers who had come out to greet them. And this is what Cuneo wrote in his diary. He said, when our caravels, the boats, the ships, were to leave for Spain, we gathered 1,600 male and female persons of those Indians, and these we embarked in our caravels on February 17, 1495. For those who remained, this is the Spaniards who were manning the island's fort, for those who remained, we let it be known in the vicinity that anybody who wanted to take any to take some of them could do so, and to the amount desired, which was done. In other words, they said to the Spanish, the Spaniards who they left behind, feel free to take these Indians as slaves as well. Cuneo further notes in his own diary that he himself, this is Columbus's right-hand man, that he himself took a beautiful teenage Carib, C-A-R-I-B, girl as his personal slave, a gift from Columbus himself, but that when he attempted to have sex with her, quote, she resisted with all her strength, end quote. So in his own words, he, quote, thrashed her mercilessly and raped her, end quote. This is what this guy wrote in his diary. Columbus referred to the Tainos as cannibals. It was a story he made up to justify his slaughter and enslavement. Actually, there's not even much evidence that he made up the story. It's just kind of made its way into the lore. Instead, in 1493, he wrote to the King and Queen of Spain, it is possible, with the name of the Holy Trinity, to sell all the slaves which it is possible to sell. Here, there are so many of these slaves, and also Brazilwood, that altogether they are living things that are as good as gold. And this was his sales pitch, basically, because he hadn't found gold. He was off in search of gold, and instead he found slaves. And he said, the slaves are just as good. They started the sex slave trade business in North America. It was a common reward for Columbus's men to be presented by him with local women to rape. As he began exporting Taino, the native tribe, as slaves to other parts of the world, the sex slave trade became an important part of the business. As Christopher Columbus himself wrote to a friend in a letter in 1500, quote, 100 castellanos, this is a Spanish coin, are as easily obtained for a woman as for a farm. And it is very general, and there are plenty of dealers who go around looking for girls. Those from 9 to 10 years old are now most in demand. End quote from Christopher Columbus. However, the Taino didn't turn out to be particularly good workers in the plantations. They didn't like the Spaniards. They didn't like the French who followed them. They attempted to fight back. So Columbus decided he was going to impose discipline on them. For even a minor offense, an Indian's nose or ear was cut off so he could go back to his village to impress the people with the brutality the Spanish were capable of. He attacked them with dogs, he skewered them with pikes, and he shot them. Eventually, life for the Taino became so unbearable that as Pedro de Cordoba, another one of the guys who was traveling with Columbus, as he wrote to King Ferdinand in a letter in 1517, and again, quoting from a letter from a guy who was there, quote, as a result of the sufferings and hard labor they endured, the Indians choose and have chosen suicide. Occasionally, 100 have committed mass suicide. The women, exhausted by labor, have shunned conception and childbirth. Many, when pregnant, have taken something to abort and have aborted. Others, after delivery, have killed their children with their own hands so as not to leave them in slavery, in such oppressive slavery. The best guess of the population of that island, which is now around 16 million, is that when Columbus arrived, it was probably around a million. By 1496, this was in 1492, by 1496 it was down to 1.1 million, according to an actual census done by Christopher Columbus's brother Bartholomew. By 1516, which is just 20 years later, the indigenous population was down to 1,200 people, according to Las Casas, another crew member of Columbus's, who was there and did a census in 1516. And by 1542, there were fewer than 200 of these natives alive. By 1555, every single one on the island, I mean, many had been exported, but by 1555, every single one was dead. Jack Forbes, I interviewed Jack Forbes when I wrote Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. He's a professor of Native American Studies at the University of California, Davis, and wrote a brilliant book called Columbus and Other Cannibals. And he used this word, which was new to me. He called it wetiko. It's a Native American word. I'm not sure, frankly, which language it comes from. That literally means cannibal. And Jack Forbes said that this is, he said it's cultural cannibalism. We live in a country that includes the principle that if somebody else has something we need and they don't want to give it to us, we have the means to kill them to get it, do it. There's oil in Iraq. Go get it. And this is nothing new, by the way. The very first Indian war in the United States was called the Pequot War of 1636. This was before Thomas Jefferson was even born. Pequot, P-E-Q-U-O-T, I think it's pronounced Pequot, in which colonists surrounded the largest of the Pequot villages, set it afire as the sun began to rise, and then shot everybody, men, women, children, the elderly, as they tried to escape. The Puritan colonist, William Bradford, described the scene. He was there. He wrote, quote, "It was a fearful sight to see them thus frying in the fire and the streams of blood quenching the same, and horrible was the stink and the scent thereof, but the victory seemed a sweet sacrifice, and the colonists gave praise thereof to God who had wrought so wonderfully." The Narragansetts, another nearby tribe and traditional adversaries of the Pequots, had been friends with the colonists up to that point. They were so shocked by this example of European-style warfare that they refused any further alliances with the whites. Captain John Underhill ridiculed the Narragansetts for their unwillingness to participate in genocidal war, saying that, this is a quote from Captain John Underhill in the 1630s, he said, the Narragansetts and other tribes have their wars, quote, more for pastime than to conquer and subdue enemies. In fact, the game of lacrosse is a remnant of that time. I mean, their wars were not to kill each other. Their wars were to, you know, to settle disputes, territorial disputes or whatever. And by and large, people didn't so often get killed. And you see this among indigenous people all over the world. I mean, they don't want to take somebody else's land. The ghosts would go with it. They don't want to kill each other because they need to have nearby tribes, you know, maintain reasonable DNA for interbreeding and whatnot. Killing of enemies is usually not the goal. But this is our history. This is our Columbus Day history. And now we have yesterday in the New York Times, front page story, "Thou shalt not kill except in a game at church." Now we have Christian churches all across the United States bringing in TV sets, computers and TV sets, and inviting teenagers to come in and play a game that is so violent that these teenagers would not be allowed to purchase it if they just went into a store. Halo 3, they control the fate of Master Chief, a tough Marine armed to the teeth who battles opponents with missiles, lasers, guns with fire spikes, energy blasters, and other fantastical weapons. Writes Matt Richel in the New York Times. How do we break this cycle of violence? 16 minutes past this.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. You know, the riff that I shared with you in the previous segment about Christopher Columbus and Columbus Day, largely I wrote up and posted it over at commondreams.org. It's there right now. It's actually an excerpt from Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, a book I wrote about, I don't know, 10, 12, 13 years ago. We've updated it since then, but originally it was published. And was the inspiration for a web movie on that Leo DiCaprio made called Global Warning, and also, I think, provided some information for his new movie, The 11th Hour, which is absolutely brilliant. And one of the folks over at Common Dreams, you know, you can kind of blog, you can comment on the posting, and one of the folks commented saying, you know, come on, you're dancing around the fact that this is Christianity that's causing this. This precedes Christianity. This precedes this is not about even organized religion. For example, there's a link off the Common Dream story toward the end to an article in yesterday's New York Times, front page article. The headline, Rape Epidemic Raises Trauma of Congo War. And they start out talking about these tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands of women in the Congo who are the victims of absolutely brutal and violent rape. It has become a major, I lack a word. It's a major, it's not even a technique of war, because it's not like there's a war going on. What has happened is that the Hutus, who had murdered Tutsis in neighboring Rwanda, had fled into the Congo after the genocide. And these people who have themselves been so wounded by being mass murderers, I mean, they're crazy. They are now coming out and murdering, and in particular raping, and it's this sexual violence. It's an astounding story in the New York Times yesterday. And this has nothing to do with Christianity. This has nothing to do with organized religion. What it has to do with is that cultures of violence breed cultures of violence. And sometimes those cultures contaminate or infect or become part of or intrinsic to religions, sometimes not. But the question for us in our culture, in our time, and I think this is really an important question, is how do we bring about a culture of nonviolence? How do we begin to hold up people like Gandhi and Martin Luther King and Jesus, for that matter, if you want to talk about the religion, who were nonviolent to the point of willing to die for their nonviolence? How do we begin to hold these people up as our cultural icons rather than the conquistadors and conquerors like Christopher Columbus? I would submit to you that we need a major cultural recalibration in this country. It's really quite remarkable. A couple of years ago, one of my books of the month for BuzzFlash.com, every month I do a book review for them, was Dag Hammarskjöld's Markings. And Dag Hammarskjöld was the second Secretary General of the United Nations. And my recollection is that he became Secretary General like in 1953 or something, and that he died in around 1961. But I may be wrong on those years. But it was around that time. It was when I was a very young child. I think I was like 9 years old when he died. But I remember it. I remember my dad talking about it. Dag Hammarskjöld, he was a Swede. He was a Scandinavian. And his book Markings is his personal diary, and it's actually a spiritual diary. There have been books written decoding it. You know, in other words, saying, here's what he was writing about and here's what was going on. You know, he's talking about violence in the world, and that was the day that Khrushchev threatened somebody, or that, you know, these kinds of things. It's really quite remarkable. The statesmen that we have had, and women that we have had in the history of the world, and yet we always revert back to violence, or so often we revert back to violence. And I'm telling you, in the coming presidential election, we have a year now before a presidential election, because moving away from pain is such a powerful short-term motivation strategy, whereas moving toward pleasure, creating a world that works, creating a view, a vision of the world that's a marvelous and wonderful place, that's a slow, long process. It's one that we absolutely need to be working on every single day, and every presidential candidate needs to be talking about it and talking about hope and talking about positive things. But because moving away from pain is so powerful, Republicans in the last, I would say, 4 or 5 presidential elections have used it largely at the last minute as a major tool. You know, Dick Cheney saying, "I vote for Democrats, Al-Qaeda's going to hit us again." I mean, this it's an emotional violence, a political violence, and an intellectual violence right across the board. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at
866-303-2270. Well, come and listen in to a radio station with a mighty host of heaven sing. Turn your radio on.
Turn your radio.
Turn your radio on.
Turn your radio on.
If you want to feel those good vibrations coming from the joy that this love can bring, turn your radio on.
Turn your radio on.
Turn your radio on.
34 minutes past the hour. You know, this whole culture of violence thing, I think it's being writ large right now in the discussion about torture. And a tip of the hat to Lawrence, who alerted me to this article in The Nation by Naomi Klein, talking about torture's dirty little secret, that it does work. It doesn't work to get information. In fact, the FBI recently declassified a document in which they compared the information that was obtained under torture in Iraq with what the FBI got using what they refer to as simple investigative techniques, end quote. You know, normal interrogation. And as Naomi Klein writes, a recently declassified memo written by an FBI official in Guantanamo states that extreme coercion produced, quote, nothing more than what FBI got using simple investigative techniques, end quote. The Army's own interrogation field manual, Naomi Klein notes, states that force, quote, can induce the source to say whatever he thinks the interrogator wants to hear, end quote. So why torture? Why does Bush want to have, why is he still rendering people to places like Uzbekistan, to nations that practice torture? Why would we want to be even discussing the threat of torture? Because it doesn't work to get information. What it works to do is terrorize people. Entire classes of people. You don't want Muslims in the United States to speak up about civil rights? Terrorize them. Threaten them with torture. You too, you could be the next Jose Padilla. This is a technique that has been used by tin pot dictators all over the world, I mean, as long as history has been around. And the real tragedy is that we are using it here now. Torture is a lousy tool to get information. In fact, some of the worst information that we've gotten as a consequence of torture, and it's led us into some really stupid things, arguably Iraq. But it does work to terrorize people so that they are afraid of the government, so that they don't speak out, so they don't stand up. The government just basically, you know, pushing fear. Jerilee in Phoenix, Arizona. Welcome to the program. Hey, Jerilee.
How are you?
I'm fine. What's up?
And we'll both get better, right?
Yeah.
This is, you just sparked a lot of things. What happened on the Sunday, I was listening to Cynthia Black, and she was going on and on and on about the Rush Limbaugh thing, and it came to me that misinformation, when you deliberately put lies out there, that you're also creating fear, because I got this little acronym that I teach people. It's called FEAR, F-E-A-R, false information appearing real. So I kind of put those two together, and it's like, That's what so they're terrorizing all of us. Because we all don't know what's going on. You don't know what's the truth. One day you say something, the next day it's not true anymore. I mean, you hear what I'm saying?
I do. And I would say that is even largely true of this administration. I mean, it's up is down, left is right.
Everywhere.
Yeah, you're with us or against us. You're, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, good point, Gerald Lee. Thank you very much. Fred in Los Angeles. Hey, Fred.
Hey, I just heard you talking about torture, and I really wanted to just first say that the death penalty tortures all of us when we are forced to sustain the cruel and unusual example that it doesn't just put on the condemned's shoulders, but on all of us who are aware of it going on. And that's a wonderful
by institutionalizing and sanctioning government-sponsored murder, that being the death penalty, by institutionalizing it and sanctioning it and even celebrating it in some cases, we coarsen and brutalize our own society. Absolutely right, Fred. And that frankly, is the strongest argument in my mind against the death penalty, and the reason why, you know, virtually every other civilized nation in the world does not have the death penalty. Josh in Bellingham, Washington. Hey, Josh.
Hey there, Tom. How are you?
Fine. What's up?
I just would like to note that in Europe they have a very different attitude towards violence, and also conversely a very different attitude towards nudity, whereas here in the United States it's quite the opposite. Nudity is very taboo, and violence is frankly embraced. And if you look at the statistics of violent crime in both Europe and the United States, you'll also notice that the violent crime rates are lower, and they just really don't care about nudity. It's just an interesting point, I think.
Yeah, it is. It's almost like, first of all, most violent crimes are committed by men, and it's almost like, you know, testosterone comes out one of two ways. It either comes out through being sexual, or it comes out through being violent. I mean, you know, I'm not making that as an absolute statement, and I'm not trying to play shrink on the radio here, but it certainly seems when you look at different cultures, like as you're pointing out, Josh, that there may be something to that. Interesting idea. Eric in Long Island, New York. Hey, Eric.
Oh, your show's terrific. Thanks for taking my calls. The really disturbing information you had earlier about Columbus. And I just want to understand, why is Columbus honored with a parade and a holiday? And why do they still teach this propaganda in elementary school that he discovered America and crap like that?
Well, it's a useful story. I mean, we have decided as a society that this is a use, that, you know, everybody has to have some sort of history. You have to have, you know, some sense of your own history. And we're...
No, but this isn't even accurate. You know he didn't discover America.
I know. No, I'm not defending first of all, you can't discover something that's already occupied.
Yeah, of course.
I remember Dick Gregory one time making a comment. He says, you know, Columbus discovering America. He says, that's like me and my wife walking down and saying, look at that TV in the window of that store. Let's discover it. come on. But the reality is that every culture has stories.
Why don't have a holiday to honor Charles Manson while they're at it? Why do they have a holiday to honor him?
Yeah, well,
do you have any clue as to why?
Because for a long time, that was the story that we built the quote discovery, European discovery of North America around, and we conveniently overlooked genocide, and we conveniently overlooked Native Americans. And I think it's frankly a good thing that we are now having these conversations. You know, 200, 300, 400 years late, but you know, it's a good thing that we're finally having the conversations. But your point is well taken. Richard in Ukiah, California. Hey, Richard.
Oh, hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to mention something on this Columbus Day article that you wrote in 2004.
Yeah.
I
wrote the first draft of it in 1996. But,
oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, and I wanted to bring it up that I came across it a year later in a sideways sense, and that I wanted to to see that you would correct what was misinformed to me on the air. Actually, I was watching television, and people brought up the entire Columbus Day celebration issue and brought it into Thanksgiving, reminding us that Thanksgiving was based on this massacre of the Pequot in 1620 when the Dutch settlers surrounded a longhouse and massacred everyone inside. Now, this is what I heard on television in 2005. Mm-hmm. And I know that it's wrong. I mean, I know that the, you know, Thanksgiving is really based on Squanto and teaching people how to put fish with corn and all that kind of stuff, and everybody at least being a little bit happier than celebrating the massacre. And not only that, it wouldn't hurt to mention that it was like 4-1 Indians in that burning of the longhouse. It wasn't. I mean, if they wanted to stop this, they certainly could have stopped it, but they didn't want to, and you know, it's not like people aren't brutal. As far as I just got done reading The Prince this weekend, people are brutal, Tom.
Niccolo Machiavelli's book?
Yeah.
The Prince? Yeah, it's an interesting reading. Yeah, yes, and what you find, if you're interested in this topic, Richard, I strongly suggest you get a copy of Peter Farb's book. Peter's been dead now for a decade, I think, or more, and the book is out of print, but it's easy to find all over the Internet. It's called Man's Rise to Civilization. And it's probably the best ethnography of first contact Native American tribes from the Pacific coast to the Atlantic coast that has ever been written.
How do you spell Farb?
F-A-R-B. Peter Farb. And it's called Man's Rise to Civilization is the title, and the subtitle is something like, the Discovery of America and the History of Native Americans or something like that. But it's Man's Rise to Civilization by Peter Farb. And what he points out is that in most cases, most of the Native American tribes in the United States, in what we now call the United States, in North America, were living relatively homeostatically. That is, they were not living in a state of constant anxiety or constant warfare. In fact, tribe A did not even want the land of tribe B because the graves of tribe B were on the land of tribe B, and the ghosts and the sacred places, and I mean, you know, it's just. And the exception to that was, for example, when some Dene people came from Canada down south about 400, 500 years ago, and it became I believe it was the Apache, and invaded the Hopi lands, and they were apparently fleeing a micro climate change, you know, basically a loss of crops. And that kind of thing, that was about it. That was the kind of thing that would produce conflict, was when one tribe came into another tribe's territory because they were, you know, they were basically fleeing starvation. But by and large, the portrayal that we have had, the historic portrayal of Native Americans as constantly at war with each other and trying to kill each other, very often, you know, counting coup, and when the first blood was drawn, that's when you stopped. Not when you really got going. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
So how do we change America to stop worshiping violence here on Columbus Day? Or, for that matter, stop worshiping Columbus. Good start. By the way, strange goings-on out there. This is incredible. U.S. Attorney Richard Gregory, Assistant U.S. Attorney. This is what the Republicans are up to. They're prosecuting these guys, these seven homeless men in Miami. In his opening statement before the jury, he says these guys were going to trigger chaos, which would allow them to take over the country and eventually the world. Or so blogs Larry Arnstein over at the Huffington Post. He notes that these guys, according to the L.A. Times, were following a mentally unbalanced man who, quote, paraded around Liberty City, Florida, in flowing robes and a head wrap, carrying a shepherd's staff. He called himself a sheikh and preached against drugs and domestic violence at a corner park on Sundays. and with the other six defendants formed a Miami chapter of the Moorish Science Temple, a sect that blends Christianity, Islam, and Judaism and claims autonomy from the U.S. government. Right. He said he knew about secret tunnels which could be used to flood Lake Toronto. There is no Lake Toronto. But the FBI got very worried about this. These guys were stopped just in the nick of time after we gave them about $100,000 in tools and weapons, and the defendants themselves brought a little pot to the party. But that was it. I mean, this is what we're going after. And it's going to be, it's another battle of the war on terror. Jerry in Long Island, New York. Hey, Jerry.
Hi. I just wanted to comment on that other worker that asked why we celebrate Columbus.
Right.
He was the first true American hero. He didn't know where he was going. He didn't know where he was when he got there. And he did it all on borrowed money.
He was the first Republican. Good one, Jerry. Thank you very much. Oh, man. Justin in Ann Arbor, Michigan, WBLY. Hey, Justin.
Hey, hey, Tom. How's it going?
Just great. What's up?
You know, it's funny. I want to make a very clear distinction here. It's funny throughout history. You have this similar action, like with going from Christopher Columbus and the colonies during the slaves. You have this induction of torture, which if you read the Willie Lynch letters, it shows you right off the bat that torture in itself against one person is not effective, but it is an effective tool against the masses. And not necessarily
right.
for specific information. But
no, you use torture for two reasons. One, to get the information that you want, regardless of its truthfulness. In other words, if you want somebody to say something, you torture them long enough, they'll say it.
Yes.
Are you a witch? Yes, I'm a witch. Okay. Yeah, so number one, you use it to get the information you want, not necessarily the information that's true. And number two, you use it as a way of terrifying a larger body of people, a larger community of people. And as such, I would submit to you that the use of torture, and including what Bush calls, or the Republicans call, enhanced interrogation techniques, is an instrument of terrorism. It is absolutely an instrument of terrorism. It is designed to terrorize people. That's just the absolute bottom line. Penny in San Pablo, California. Hey, Penny.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on your show. I just wanted to make a couple of points about Columbus and the colonization of the United States, the Americas. I'm Native American. I live in the San Francisco Bay Area. And not only have Native American people been colonized, but at this point it's every U.S. citizen that's been colonized. And what the corporations, the first multinational corporations, were doing all over the world, they're now actually doing it in our own communities across the lands. They're putting in their corporate arms and they're vacuuming out the resources, whether it be a Walmart or a refinery company or a chemical company. What they did to us and what they continue to do to us, they're doing now to every American. And so I think that it's important to see that what happens with one community happens to all of us. And the whole idea of Native philosophy that we're all related, we're all connected, you know, I think that this is a perfect example of that.
Yeah, it comes back to the saying from during the Vietnam War that the war always comes home. You know, that you can't perpetrate violence on other people without that violence coming back to you. You become the violence.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
You know, and I wanted to make another point about Columbus Day. In San Francisco in the early 90s, we had the 500 years of resistance movement going on across the country. And when the Italian community was approached by the indigenous community here and educated about what Columbus actually did and who the kind of person that he was, they changed Columbus Day to Italian American Day. And in Berkeley, we celebrate Indigenous Peoples Day, and it's actually on the parking meters.
Oh, interesting. Interesting.
Yeah.
Penny, thanks for the heads up and the information on that. That's fascinating. Thomas in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hey, Thomas.
Hey, Tom. I'm a big fan. Thanks for taking the call. Hey, you were talking about war, you know, the war culture here in the United States. I don't know if you've heard, George Carlin's bit on this. He mentions that, you know, not only is our foreign policy about war, but our domestic policies about war. You know, whenever there's a problem, it's the war on drugs, it's the war on poverty, the war on AIDS. We just we declare war on everything.
Right. And it's nuts. It's a lousy metaphor. Number one, it further brutalizes our society. And you're absolutely right. And even I think that it's time. And Woodrow Wilson actually talked about this, and Dag Hammarskjöld talked about this at some length before he died in a plane crash and flying in to try to end the war in Angola when he was Secretary General of the United Nations. Of saying that war is no longer a legitimate instrument, period, of statecraft or of response. It just it, war. Let us work. John Kennedy was so eloquent about this. Actually, I've played the clips enough times on this program. I'm not going to replay them today, but so eloquent on this. It is time for us to consider peace as an active and positive process. That peace is something that we can work toward, and that war is something that we should just say, sorry, we're not going to do that anymore. You know, we've seen where that goes. There is no positive outcome from it. Yes, of course, you defend yourself if somebody attacks you. But the fact of the matter is that no two democracies have ever attacked each other in the history of the world. And so let's spread democracy, and let's do it by example. 57 minutes past.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio. The Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Talk radio for the rest of us.
I was in Washington, D.C. yesterday and the day before. Spoke at the Green Festival. And saw my old friend Alex Hershev. I haven't seen Alex since 1981. Alex runs an organization called Farm. It's basically promoting vegetarianism, veganism. In fact, he gave me a ride back to my hotel after the after I spoke at the Green Conference. And was talking about the violence that is so pervasive in our society, even in the way that we eat, in what we call sport. And I frankly think that this is... Corrections Corporation of America, a private prison company, is likely to see, according to Barron's magazine, you know, the big business magazine, is likely to see its profits rise 20%. This is from USA Today today. Prison stocks are expected to rise despite a recent U.S. Census report pointing to a lower than expected rise in prison population. Barron's reported in today's edition, the census report, which said U.S. prisons population is growing 4% annually. This countered a study by Pew Charitable Trust that forecast an increase of 13% annually. We'll see, you know, which it is. But nonetheless, they're expecting the Correction Corporation of America's profits to rise. We have declared a war on drugs and a war on crime. And the consequence of this is that we now have a very profitable prison industry. Isn't it time for us to start reevaluating our national priorities? How do we end the war on drugs and the war on terror and the war on, I mean, you know, fill in the blank? Adbusters did a brilliant ad a couple of years ago about how gross national product is no way to measure the quality of life. Here it is.
For years, economists have the economic health of a country by its gross domestic product. Trouble is, every time a forest falls, the GDP goes up. With every oil spill, the GDP goes up. Every time a cancer patient is diagnosed, the GDP goes up. Is this how we measure economic progress? Economists must learn to subtract.
Indeed. Indeed. We are spending, we are now launching a billion-dollar, quote, Plan Mexico, and end quote. The U.S. intends to supply Mexico, this reporting by Adam Thompson in San Jose, Costa Rica, the U.S. intends to supply Mexico with $1 billion aid package to help combat an increasingly costly and violent war against drugs, according to a top Mexican diplomat. This, by the way, is seen as a good thing, as a victory for Felipe Calderon, the right-wing president of Mexico. Since coming to power in December, he's made anti-narcotics policy a priority, although it doesn't seem to be producing much result. As noted in the article, some argue that the military presence has often been ineffective. The truth is that the U.S. is jointly responsible for what is happening to us, Calderon told the Financial Times in an interview this year. In that joint responsibility, the U.S. has a lot of work to do. Yeah. And our war on terror, including, as George Bush would say, the Iraq flank of it, according to Reuters, the war on terror is failing and instead fueling an increase in support for extremist Islamist movements. According to the Oxford Research Group, this is a British think tank, they say a fundamental rethink is required. They say if the Al-Qaeda movement is to be countered, then the roots of its support must be understood and systematically undercut. This is Paul Rogers, the report's author. Professor of Global Peace Studies at Bradford University, Northern England. A professor of peace studies? What a novel idea. He says, combined with conventional policing and security measures, Al-Qaeda can be contained and minimized. But this will require a change in policy at every level. He described the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq as a disastrous mistake, which had helped establish the most valued jihadist combat training zone for all Al-Qaeda supporters. The title of the report, by the way, is Alternatives to the War on Terror. He says it's going to take at least 10 years to make up for the mistake since 9/11. What kind of an economy do we want to have? What kind of a world do we want to have? Where are our priorities and our values? When we think that, isn't it a great thing that the private prison industry is booming? This is another reason why the prison business should never have been privatized in the first place. Because you don't want an industry out there lobbying for itself when that industry has to do with locking people up or putting them to death. And you don't want a GDP or a GNP, as it used to be referred to, gross domestic product, gross national product, you don't want that to be measured solely by, you know, the flow of goods and services, because as Adbusters pointed out, you know, a cancer diagnosis improves the GDP by $250,000. Every time a person's diagnosed with cancer, $250,000, bing, up goes the economy. Is that the kind of thing that we want? Bobby Kennedy addressed this many years ago, and brilliantly so.
Too much and for too long, we seem to have surrendered personal excellence and community values in the mere accumulation of material things. Our gross national product now is over $800 billion a year. But that gross national product, if we judge the United States of America by that, that gross national product counts air pollution and cigarette advertisements and ambulances to clear our highways of carnage. It counts special locks for our doors and the jails for the people who break them. It counts the destruction of the redwoods and the loss of our natural wonder in chaotic sprawl. It counts napalm, and it counts nuclear warheads and armored cars for the police to fight the riots in our cities. It counts Whitman's rifles and Speck's knife and the television programs which glorify violence in order to sell toys to our children. Yet the gross national product does not allow for the health of our children, the quality of their education, or the joy of their play. It does not include the beauty of our poetry or the strength of our marriages, the intelligence of our public debate, for the integrity of our public officials. It measures neither our wit nor our courage, neither our wisdom nor our learning, neither our compassion nor our devotion to our country. It measures everything in short, except that which makes life worthwhile. And it can tell us everything about America, except why we are proud that we are Americans.
Indeed. Indeed. And so, and thus, in the midst of this, this article on the front page of the New York Times yesterday about a church using violent video games to bring kids in so that they can evangelize them. and teach them about Jesus. Who would Jesus kill in a video game? And then you've got, you know, these rapture video games that are growing, and the rapture movies and all these kind of things. And in the meantime, in Afghanistan, huge poppy crop coming in. What are we doing? We're out there spraying herbicides, which kill everything, making farmland unusable. It's just amazing. In this war on drugs, our policies are not working. Bagram Air Force Base, this the largest air base in Afghanistan, the largest U.S. Air Force base in Afghanistan, used to be a Soviet Air Force Base back when there was a Soviet Union, Grandpa Fred. And now this is, it's grown, it's a third larger than it was when we invaded Iraq, or Afghanistan, rather. We are finding ourselves in Afghanistan in a situation not that different from what the Soviet Union found themselves in. The Afghanis saying, hey, this is our country, get out. And then we're trying to mess with their economy, saying, oh, you shouldn't grow opium poppies. Instead of offering them an alternative, instead of offering them something else that they can do, we simply go in and spray with herbicides and say, oh, we're gonna scorch earth your land. We're doing the same thing down in Peru and Colombia, where we're mostly indigenous people are growing coca leaves. And what's the consequence? They can't grow anything. Because the herbicide renders the land sterile. It makes the earth sterile. Even weeds won't grow on it. And so what happens? People end up in the cities and the slums. And you've got social unrest and social ferment and a ripe area for the demagogues that we refer to as terrorists. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. We've been talking about violence and torture and Christopher Columbus, this Columbus Day, and just the whole intertwining of it, a society built on violence. And how do we fundamentally change that? How do you turn a violent society into a less violent society? How do you create a world at peace? What are the steps? What are the pieces that go to make that up? How do you bring it about? Yeah, I think that there's a broad consensus that we need to. It's just, you know, the question, how? How do you go about doing it? I would say as a start, we need to reclaim the core values of this country, even when they weren't perfectly acted out. Yes, I know in the beginning of this country, there was a massive genocide of Native Americans. There was slavery. Women were not enfranchised in most parts of the United States. And on and on, you know, I mean, we can come up with a long catalog of the ills, but the ideals were there. They came out of the Enlightenment, out of the 1600s, and we have evolved continuously, I believe, in a positive direction up until the last 20 years or so. And the New Deal, Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal, was the most recent forward motion in the evolution of this nation toward a more perfect republic, toward a peaceful nation, toward a nation at peace, toward a world at peace. Set the stage for John Kennedy to talk about peace. And then Reagan came along and said, no, we're going to reverse the New Deal. We're going to undo it. We're going to undo those programs. We're going to take it apart.
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
Yes, Rush. Now, back in your box. And And since then, now it's getting even progressively more and more violent. And Paul Krugman today, a brilliant op-ed in the New York Times, pointing out George W. Bush is not an anomaly or an aberration. You've got a bunch of Republicans running around going, he's not any kind of conservative like I am. Sorry, as Paul Krugman absolutely and accurately points out, George W. Bush has been is doing what conservatives have been doing since virtually the beginning of the modern conservative movement. Borrow and spend like crazy, do things for political expediency, to hell with the people. And a progressively more coarse and violent society, to the point now that we are torturing people and celebrating it in some cases. Why? Because it's an effective instrument of terror against all of us. Nancy Pelosi yesterday was asked, did you even know about this memo that Gonzo wrote in 2005 allowing for torture? She says,
All I know is what I've read in the New York Times.
You were never briefed about these secret memos in 2005?
No, not about the secret memos.
No. Now, she's on the Intelligence Committee. She's supposed to have access to all this information. Congress is supposed to provide a check and a balance to the power of the executive branch. The executive branch has an obligation by law to provide information to the legislative branch about how they're conducting the affairs that the legislative branch authorizes, such as the action into Iraq, to the extent that it was authorized. I mean, I think it's important for us to remember that the authorizing legislation, the legislation that, you know, the so-called war authorization that John Edwards and Hillary Clinton voted for and that Barack Obama says he was opposed to, although he didn't have an option of voting because he wasn't in the Senate at the time, and Dennis Kucinich voted against, that legislation was not an authorization for war. What that legislation said was that if the president comes back to Congress and presents in writing evidence, a statement, a sworn statement in writing to Congress that Saddam Hussein and Iraq had something to do with 9/11, then military force would be justified to use against him. And Bush, in fact, did submit a letter to Congress saying just that. And it was a lie, and he knew it was a lie at the time. One more impeachable offense. Right now we are 469 days, 10 hours, 27 minutes out until he leaves office voluntarily. But it would be so cathartic to this nation for there to be an impeachment in the House of Representatives. Keep in mind, an impeachment is not a removal from office. An impeachment is an indictment. An impeachment is a statement, we're not going to put up with this anymore. Or at least do what Russ Feingold is suggesting over in the Senate and have a censure resolution. At the very least. As a way of beginning the process of healing this nation, we have had, as Jack Kennedy said so brilliantly in 1963 at Michigan State University, he said, we have had enough of war. We don't want more war. It's time to begin healing this nation. It's time to begin pulling it back together. It's time for this 27-year-old long national nightmare to come to an end. And the way to do that is for us to hold a positive vision of America, a positive vision of peace as a proactive force, and then get out there and get politically active and get involved to help bring that about. 866-303-2270, our telephone number, TomHartman.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room, 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Brighter future that we all got so
Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. When are we going to go back to the idea of statecraft? Of being a nation with a mission and a high ideal?
We're not a warlike people. We've never sought glory as a nation of warriors. We're not interested in aggression. We are not interested, as the dictators are, in looting. We do not covet one square inch of the territory of any other nation.
Franklin Delano Roosevelt. That was before, of course, Don Rumsfeld came along. Michael in Hollywood, California. Welcome to the program, Michael.
Hey, how you doing? Hey, Tom, first of all, I got to thank you for being on the front lines, if you excuse the war analogy. And I got your back, and I got your front if I can get there. But
okay, thank you, Michael.
I don't know if you remember a couple of years ago they occasionally announced what books George Bush is reading if he can get through the first page. Mm-hmm. But a few years ago they mentioned that he was reading a book called Salt. Had you ever read that one?
No, I haven't.
It's a wonderful one. It's one of my favorite history books.
Oh, this is the book that's the history of salt, how salt has changed civilizations and cultures.
And armies and everything. It's just wonderful. But while reading that, I learned a bit about Columbus, because he was involved in the salt and the fish trade. And he was Genoan, and he's actually a traitor. He fought against his own country so he could pirate more of the salt trade.
Interesting.
Yeah, and I read this in the book, and I was just, and by the way, I was in Berkeley when they had their Indigenous People Day last year.
Yeah. Columbus was a Genoan. Genoa was a city-state in what is now Italy, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
When he came to North America, he was coming on behalf of the King and Queen of Spain. So he was basically a
mercenary. Well, he had already lost his country. He had fought against it in the wars for the trade over there. If you get a chance to read the book, I highly, highly recommend it. It is really my favorite history book at this point.
Very interesting. Okay, I'll take a look for it, Michael. Thank you very much. Salt. I'll check it out. Roman in Long Island. Hey, Roman.
Hey, how are you today?
I'm fine, but I'll get better. What's up?
How's the weather out there in Portland?
I don't know. What's on your mind, Roman? I'm inside the studio. I can't see outside.
Some curiosities. As far as I can tell, the euphemism of the Iraq War is actually incorrect, because George Bush ended all military action on the flight deck of the Abraham Lincoln. Is that correct?
That's correct. When Bush said,
"My fellow Americans, major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed."
He was right. He was right. That was the end of the war and in the beginning of the occupation.
Why is it that the international? I mean, this is where international law then becomes tantamount, doesn't it? Because
it should.
The U.S. really doesn't have the rights that they're claiming as far as the Blackwater or the usage of the oil or just about anything else that's going on.
That's right. We are in violation of United Nations conventions. We're in violation of the Hague treaties. We're in violation of several of the treaties that were signed by the United States after World War II, in addition to, you know, those that came to be part of international law through the United Nations. You're right.
Because I was reading a piece out of The Economist where they were wondering about the law, the legal deal that was struck by Hunt Oil on the grounds that, guess what, we're the occupying army and we're really not allowed to make the kind of deals that we are.
Yeah, we talked about that on this program last week, that the Hunt Oil Company has just cut a deal with the Kurds in the northern part of Iraq, who want to be autonomous Kurdistan, which is sure to cause a war with Turkey if it happens. But nonetheless, they noted in the article that the Hunt brother, who is, you know, put this deal together, is an old friend and major campaign contributor, not just to the Republican Party, but to George W. Bush, and now set to make lots and lots and lots of money on having an oil business in northern Iraq. Not that, you know, I mean, it's just like Blackwater. Blackwater was a company. I'm quite certain I'm right on this. It's conceivable that I'm wrong, but this is how it's been reported in the press. Blackwater was a company that basically started out with shooting ranges and, you know, NRA-style safety training and stuff like that. And they weren't doing very well until this war started. And now they're a multi-billion-dollar company. But they didn't used to. Before the war in Iraq, they were not a multi-billion-dollar company. It was a little outfit that wasn't doing all that well. And well, Halliburton's stock has almost tripled since the beginning of the war. I mean, it's just, it's war is a very, very profitable thing, period. And another reason why, you know, it should be banned. Brian in Boulder, Colorado.
Hi, Tom. Quickly, regarding the war on drugs, a year or two ago, listening to a local talk show here in the Denver area, I was surprised. A very ordinary sounding man. He stated that we'll never end the war on drugs until we find other jobs for all those DEA agents and the foot soldiers. And I thought that was very cogent.
Yeah, it is. And there's a grain of truth there. I'm not sure there's that many.
And regarding the war on terror, I want to make a comment. George Bush Sr., as you probably know, is a member of the Carlyle Group. The Carlyle Group, I have read, holds a licensing agreement and receives a royalty on every Bradley fighting vehicle that is sold.
Yeah, the Carlyle Group is invested in a number of defense contractors who are making money in Iraq, and the Carlyle Group has spectacularly performed as a consequence of our invasion and ongoing occupation of Iraq. Absolutely, Brian. Good point. Kara in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Kara.
Oh, hey. Good morning, Tom. Yeah, a little critique here. You were saying how to change violent society. You know, and I kind of wish you'd say that how to change a complex society with a violent power structure, because, you know, I'm part of the society, and that sounds so all-encompassing, and I don't feel like I'm a violent person. You know, I have actually worked with survivors of torture. I'm involved in peace work. I'm a survivor myself of domestic violence, and I have found, as a survivor with domestic violence, and because I work with survivors of torture, that I think that we have, as survivors of domestic violence and any kind of violence, men or women, we have instincts around abuses of power. The first time I heard George Bush, you know, back in 2000 in the debates, the first time I heard him, I knew that he was a proto-fascist just from the way he talked. Because there were patterns in the way he talked that were similar to the way abusers and violent people talk. So lack of empathy, you know, Matthew Shepard, for example, in one of the debates, he talked about the victim of Matthew Shepard. And I could tell that he was not deeply empathetic.
And making fun of Carla Faye Tucker when he executed her. And I mean, that even creeped out Tucker Carlson, who, you know, was a conservative supporter of George Bush's, and it totally creeped him out when Bush did his imitation of Carla Faye and said, "Please, Mr. Governor Bush, please save my life," and then he starts laughing hysterically. Now, you're right, Kara, and it's a distinction that I appreciate. Thank you, Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Gary.
Thanks, Tom, for taking my call. I listened very with interest the last half an hour, and boy, I can't agree with you more that the philosophy of the New Deal is our last best hope. And in that context,
De Tocqueville,
the philosopher. I think he had a pretty good quote, and he said that, if I may, he said, "What is most important for democracy is not that great fortune should not exist. It's that they should not remain in the same hands. That way they don't form a class."
Interesting. Yeah. Is that from Democracy in America? I had not encountered that before.
And I heard this new term is kind of interesting in that vein, is that Bush and Cheney have rediscovered a new form here in America between, it's not the have and have nots, it's the have and have mores.
That's right. Yeah, and that was Bush's joke before a group of very, very wealthy donors, and tragically, it's becoming increasingly true. Liz in Los Angeles. Thank you, Gary. Liz in Los Angeles. Hey, Liz.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I know you mentioned I'm going to say Department of Peace with England, somebody in England or Englishman. You know, Kucinich. I just pray and hope. Well, maybe I don't pray, but. That he will get in, because he said as soon as he gets in, he will initiate a Department of Peace. And when he first said it, like I heard him on, I guess, a debate when they gave him 2 seconds to respond, you know, I thought, what a great idea. And I am a descendant of Patrick Henry, and we are losing our liberties. And people, please, please listen to this man. He's neither party in my heart. I mean, he's just a good, and he's very intelligent.
Dennis, you're talking about Dennis Kucinich.
Oh, I am. I don't know if I said his name. And I thank you, Tom. I have disagreed with you in the past, but you're pretty much right on. And I guess that's
really
easier.
Thank you. Thank you, Liz. I appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you very much for the call. I absolutely agree with Dennis Kucinich that we need to have a Department of Peace and a cabinet level Department of Peace. And I remember when I first, you know, the idea of when I first learned of the idea was probably 8 or 9 years ago. And I thought that sounds kind of flaky. And then, as I recall, it was Marianne Williamson who described it to me. We at a meeting that we were both speaking at, and she said, as a cabinet level officer, the person who's in charge of the Department of Peace would be there to advocate for peace in any conversation with the president's cabinet, right there along with the Department of Defense, essentially the Department of War. So you would have somebody who would always bring up the topic and always and looking at peace as a positive and proactive force. I think it's a great idea. 45 minutes past the hour.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
You're in. The president kicked democracy out the door and he shipped it off to a foreign shore, giving birth instead to a holy war. I don't know why those Iraqis got so sore. We only killed 100,000 no more. It's called
back 9 minutes before the hour. Search for Common Ground is a great organization with ventures literally all over the world. The director of programs for Search for Common Ground, their website, by the way, sfcg.org, as in Search for Common Ground.org. The director of programs for Search for Common Ground in Nepal is with us, Michael Shipler. Michael, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Nice to be with you.
Glad to have you with us. You just came back from Nepal. What's going on there?
Well, the situation has been quite complicated over the last few weeks. There's an ongoing peace process to bring to an end a 10-year civil war that has been fought between the Communist Party of Nepal, Maoist, and the government. Peace agreement was signed in November of last year. Was intended to lead to an election that was going to take place in November 22nd. Those elections have just been suspended, unfortunately, due to a political impasse that is ongoing.
Mm. Hi, this has got to be one of the biggest issues, one of the biggest problems that any nation can confront. We certainly did here in the United States during Reconstruction. South Africa did when the big change happened. And that is, how do you heal a nation from the wounds of civil war? Or of war, period. You know, how do you go about that? And what is Search for Common Ground doing to help bring about that kind of healing around the world?
Post-conflict transition is, of course, quite a complicated process where there have been very stark political and social ethnic divisions that have opened up over the course of quite a long period of war. There are several very key components to it. In a situation like Nepal, one of the main elements is actually building a democracy and actually creating a democratic system in which civil society organizations or organizations can actually interact effectively with the government. Building a strong media that, like you guys, like your show, which can actually really create a public dialogue on major issues of the day and create opportunities for the citizenry of a society to really speak to the government about those main issues that they're facing. Our work in Nepal has really been focused on working with those sectors of society who've been most affected by the war and have a lot of potential to contribute to building peace. We do a lot of work with young people. As in many conflicts around the world, you know, maybe the decisions to go to war are made by the elders, but the wars are actually fought by youth and by children. So we've done a lot of work helping equip young people to manage the impacts of a conflict on their lives and actually to play a role in building peace, reaching out their hands across political and ethnic divisions to build peace. We also work quite a bit with the media. You know, you can see in most conflict zones, the media can play a major role in, you know, in exacerbating divisions and exacerbating conflict. They can also
play a
major role.
Well, in Rwanda, wasn't it by and large talk radio that inflamed the genocide of the Hutus against the Tutsis?
Yeah, indeed. The talk radio was used and entertainment radio was used really to foster hatred and violence. Exactly. And so
you're flipping that around in Nepal. You're using radio to prevent revenge killings.
Exactly. What we do is we use radio, and we're training a lot of radio talk show hosts to bring people together from across dividing lines to look for constructive solutions to the complex problems that they're facing.
That's
exactly.
Great. Tell us about your Child Soldier Initiative in Ghana.
So what we're doing, we've been working together with a number of partners, including UNICEF Canada, the office of General Romeo Dallaire, who was the commander of the peacekeeping forces in Rwanda in 1994. He's now a senator in Canada. And what we're trying to do is to really develop some tools that can be used on the ground in war zones to prevent the use, conscription and use of children as soldiers. And so our purpose really is to look at how are children being used by armed groups and what can we actually do to try to stop armed groups from recruiting and using children. It's a gross violation, of course, of children's rights and crime against humanity to be conscripting children as young as, you know, 7, 8 years old at times to fight wars for adults. So we really need to find a way of actually preventing that from happening.
The front page of the New York Times yesterday had a story about how the Hutus who in Rwanda had perpetrated the genocide on the Tutsis had fled into the Congo as that situation was resolving itself. And they are now living out in the bush, forming these dysfunctional Lord of the Flies kind of communities and raiding communities with, you know, widespread, you know, literally rape and pillage. I mean, you know, in fact, rape was the focus of the article. What do you do when you're confronted with something like that? I mean, how do you break these cycles of violence?
I think that the unfortunate reality of modern warfare is that it's waged often against civilian populations, isn't it? And the real main challenges that we have to face is about, you know, what we do really is to try to build bridges across all the different dividing lines that exist in any given society where this is taking place. So in Burundi, which is also ethnically equivalent to Rwanda, where you have Hutus and Tutsi, what Search for Common Ground is doing is trying to create relationships between those two ethnic communities. Particularly in that country, it's really effective to be working with women. We bring women's associations from both sides of the divide together to really look at how they can build partnerships and relationships with one another.
That's great. Michael Shipler, Search for Common Ground, sfcg.org, the website. Thank you, Michael, for the great work you're doing and for being on the program with us today.
Great. Thank you very much for having me. Appreciate it.
Good speaking with you. Coming up tomorrow, I'll be challenging Dr. Michael Brown on his article that you can't be a Christian and be gay. Say what? David Sirota is going to be here. That and the best of the rest of the news and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.